Dalkeith popular. She is one of the many deities that live and thus compete for power in an onchol, that literally is the hem of a sari, and by extension a marginal territory, the periphery of a wider map. So she is the goddess of a people. An oncholic devi, Shitala, has no standard myth nor a shared ritual praxis. And this has contributed to generate some degree of confusion in academic discourses on and around her worship. In Bengal, where the goddess is endemic, there exist several conflicting logics, and the most popular and authoritative is the one delivered by the Shitala Mongolkapya, the logistic sagas composed in Bengali from around the second half of the 17th century. And here there are some of the main authors, because in fact there are many of them. This literature, produced only by Brahmins, was sponsored by royalty and affluent gentry. Authors wrote their poems in order first to secure a source of income, when in fact they were professional poets, then to entertain. Mongolkapya were hyper-romantic tales of love and devotion, or alternative gruesome stories of battle, death, horror and blood. So in other words, they can be labeled some sort of pulp fiction, really. To secure authenticity, Mongol poets were sincere devotees of the goddess, who did their best to legitimate Shitala's presence in a social environment, that is, middle and upper class culture with the gods and goddesses. So these are the motivations. But the oral folklore of rural Bengal and other areas of North India, which Mongol poets borrowed material for their stories, bears witness to some features that the Bhadralok gentry were not interested into. For instance, Shitala in the Mongolkapya is a non-ritual goddess. The kernel of her story revolves around neglect. Humans and gods do not respect Shitala. Revenge, Shitala punishes everybody, sending terrible diseases. And reconciliation, human and gods acknowledge Shitala's power and promise to worship her. Although Shitala asks to be worshipped, there is no reference to the way of worshipping her. Acknowledgement of her power, motivated by the fear she is supposed to inspire, seems enough. But in a nutshell, educated and wealthy elites were saying through a successful literary product that the religion of folks is built on a do-ut-des logic. The culture of the peasants is represented as a pedagogy of fear, where the disadvantaged one learns how to respect higher powers only after punishment. In fact, Shitala is a protector. She can be aggressive, but only towards enemies, and these enemies are generally outsiders, particularly working-class exploiters, or natural phenomena like diseases, famines, earthquakes, droughts, etc. In exchange of her protection, she asks to be honored and kept alive, that is, nourished. But feeding the goddess is not something one can do with love and devotion only. Shitala, as they say, is one of us, so she needs food, hence the need to offer her the best food, that is, meat. Animal sacrifice, however, is in decline. In Bengal, sacrifices to honor Shitala were quite common, yet the goddess is rapidly changing, a phenomenon that coincides with her increased popularity among local middle class. This process, I have reason to believe, began around the 17th century, with the formation of new geopolitical assets in Bengal, confirmed itself during the 19th century and intensified dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. The Shitala Mongolkapya are the ideal starting point to explore how the gentrification of the goddess contributed to change ritual practice and eventually to create yet one more Shitala. The gulf between Mongolkapya and the practice of the mostly rural working class is amplified by the way ritual is represented and manipulated. Male patrons and Brahmins, poets, promote a worship that is built on bhakti, devotion. Where for peasants, puja, as they say, coincides with animal sacrifice, whereas bhakti is heavily dependent on phenomena of possession, either ritualistic or ecstatic. And this is called bor, which literally means weight. Recovery and restoration of a disrupted order are two further and related issues. In Mongol Kabyon, the healing process is not dependent on a particular form of sacrifice or ritual. In general, this is subsidiary to an acknowledgement of authority. This resembles the dynamics of power regulating the existence between the local working class and the power bloc. So just like farmers pay taxes to local zamindar or royalty and must show a reverence regulated by the Shastric norm, every human being residing in the Anchal visited by Shitala is expected to act in the very same way. So a significant divide exists between the literature produced by the Upajati and the texts of the Anchalita. In the former instance, the presence of the goddess by means of gentrification, romanticization, and exoticism is functional to reinforce and perpetuate logics of control. In the latter, Shitala means protection from what we can call uneven development, that is, social and natural forces of oppression. And at the same time, it indicates how power, symbolic or actual, is eventually distributed so as to suggest social countermeasures as well as class consciousness. Sacrifice is therefore a duty because it keeps Shitala alive and alert in the community. But despite its importance, the culture of animal sacrifice is vanishing. Celebration of the goddess Shitala are increasingly limited to vegetarian presentation. Many devotees and pujaris, especially those who relocated in medium or big urban centers from rural settlements, claim that Shitala never required the slaying of living beings. She is a peaceful goddess. So they make a distinction between Bolidan, this blood and flesh offering, and Puja, vegetarian offering, where the former epitomizes backwardness and superstition, and the latter reflects peace, love, and harmony. The gentrification of sacrifice in the worship of Shitala has assumed large-scale proportion. I impute this to two facts. First, Shitala is an Anchalic Devi, not a pan-Hindu goddess with a shared background, solidly rooted in literary sources or charismatic center of worship. Second, unlike other Hindu goddesses, she is not a Shakti. Her origins are subaltern, and for several centuries she has been associated to marginal, exploited communities. Attempts to elevate her to a higher rank have simply created another Shitala, a bourgeois goddess with other needs and requirements. Now I'll show you some iconography. It's an Anchalic iconography, non-anthropomorphic murtis, the Shila, basically. Slab stones. Then again, Anchalic iconography. This is from Jharkhand Adivasi, warrior, breast naked Shitala, and then again the Digambar Shitala. And here is what I call the bourgeois Shitala. It's completely different. This is very much evident in so many temples across North India, in particular West Bengal. I will now move on to a more practical analysis of ritual sacrifice, the devotion and devotion in the context of Shitala worship. This is based on fieldwork conducted in the town of Shalkya, Howrah district, West Bengal. When every year, the Shidan Jatra, it's also called Chan Jatra, is celebrated on the 15th of March. Attracting thousands of devotees, the festival is the occasion to celebrate Shitala as a loving, benevolent, and protective mother. Shitala, however, has many forms. The most ancient and authoritative is indisputably Chotto Ma, the small, younger mother. Here she is. See how she is different from the bourgeois Shitala I showed you before. The temple of Chotto Ma is actually a small family shrine located in Upendranath Mitra Lane. The current Shaivite, Shri Pradip Kumar Chottaji, here she is, runs a marriage registration office for our contingent. The Chan Jatra is no doubt the busiest moment of the year for the temple, when Chotto Ma is visited by thousands of pilgrims on their way to the ghat on the Hooghly River, where communal bath takes place. Shitalas from Shalkya are brought in procession. So all the Shitalas from this city visit Chotto Ma. These are Major Ma, which is the second born mother. Here there is a better picture. Then there is Shejo Ma, third born mother. And Boro Ma, the old big mud. Pilgrims are expected to bathe after the procession, but many gather from an early collective ablution before the Jatra at their arrival. During the walk leading to the goddess temples, phenomena of individual and collective possession are extremely common and are viewed as a much-needed proof of the auspicious presence of the goddess. But possession is also a way to claim or to challenge power in and across specific contexts like family, jat, gender, political faith, etc. It is thus not unusual that many, especially women or migrants, are accused to cheat, to enact fake possession, or to be pagal, as they say, to be mad. Contention also features the day after the Chandjatra, which is dedicated to Boroma. This form of Shitala is radically different. Boroma is believed to be potentially dangerous and is a hungry goddess. The ritual killing of animals is the distinctive feature of her service, a performance aiming at pleasing, feeding, and thanking the goddess. Regardless its importance, Boli Dan does not enjoy much popularity. The Shaivites of the temple are indicated by outsiders as ignorant and violent. Such views are validated on a broader scale. In contemporary Bengal, practices such as possession and sacrifice are objected by intellectuals, students, teachers, the middle class, the media, and religious authorities, especially if they have some sort of political affiliation. In this climate, many facets of local folklore are increasingly dismissed, diminished, and ridiculed as a heterogeneous block of backward practices and superstition. The form of possession that take place during the procession are called by everybody Bhor. Although some linguistic minorities from UP and Bihar call it Pesi, hearing. The fact that the Bengali word is used and Bengali or Bengalized Sanskrit is the language of all ritual and non-ritual activities, performances, it's significant in that it confirms the bond of Shitala with the Anchal, with the territory. Nevertheless, a large number of pilgrims are known Bengalis, mainly Bihari migrants whose first language is either Hindi, Bhojpuri, or to a lesser degree Maithili. These languages, as I had the chance to observe, are not used in public ritual settings, but are spoken during possession. If a Hindi or Bhojpuri speaker is possessed by the goddess, then Shitala expresses herself in these languages, and so communicates with other deities or human beings. The large majority of possessed persons are female devotees, talking 80-85%. During the time I spent in Chalkya, I witnessed very few males undergoing possession. A significant presence, though not numerically speaking, is that of the hijra, the third sex, as they call them. Not only do hijras take active part to many rituals, even those reserved to males, like the Boli Dan, the sacrifice. Also, they seem to be the source of a special power. Just like the goddess, who is not a functional mother, they give what they have not, that is fertility. For the community, their connection with Shitala Devi is unquestionable, and in that, their blessing is very much sought for. One of the most striking examples I observed took place during the communal bath at the end of the procession. A hijra, whom I will call Nandini, apparently in a state of controlled bore, was walking towards the ghat, surrounded by a considerable crowd making space for her. The immersion was eagerly followed by other pilgrims who were waiting to touch Debi, as Nandini was called, as an auspicious event. After the bath, the pilgrims' small goti, the pitchers, containing water, mustard oil, and kumkum powder, were quickly poured on the head of Nandini, who at that point theatrically dishveled her hair, though, and let devotees collect the pouring water again in their small vessels. And this water, called Mongoljol, auspicious water, was a special value to women wishing to conceive. I'll show you some snapshots. Here she is. This is when they are emptying the kuti. And this is the last part. And this is the kuti with Mongoljol. Right. The relation between gender and possession is a tense one, especially because women can express their criticism towards male family members. In Shakya, possession is not a ritualistic performance. The dynamics of possession, particularly its pedagogical element and polemic rationale, are thus open to criticism. The fact that there is no social established authority control contributes to generate manifold, often contrasting, interpretations, some of which are openly directed at casting stigma on the possessed one. Bohr is explained by informants as an unexpected yet not unwelcome event depending on devotion, and the dramatic perception of trouble, or shubida, and pain, dukkha. Some women, I learned, know how to invite the goddess. As I have been explained, the trick is to concentrate on the feeling of discomfort or its origin. Two women who agreed to talk to me, Bulbul and Rina, but obviously they are pseudonyms, are two cousins in their early 20s. Their families came from Bihar in the 1980s. Their first language is Bhojpuri, but they are proficient in Hindi and have been educated in Bengali. They both finished secondary school. Bulbul and Rina have been forced into marriage by their families and are now housewives. Their husbands, also from Bihar but recent migrants working in local factories, have the habit of drinking, and minor episodes of domestic violence are regular. Both women seem not to find any support from their families and feel abandoned. They fear that should they conceive, the same sad destiny will affect their offspring, particularly a female. The manipulation of possession, not in a negative sense, obviously, enacted by Bulbul and Rina, is not a matter of secrecy. Both women know exactly what to do and why they are doing it. In their words, it is a way to find relief, to say aloud that we are not respected. Just like them, other women admit that they know how to get possessed, and although the trigger may be different, many stories point at the frustration of being childless or the stigma that a particular condition attracts, for instance, vitiligo. The manifestation is invariably aimed at denouncing a situation of relative injustice. Possessed devotees do not define themselves as health seekers or sick persons. Rather, they aim at reconciling a situation of imbalance that has negatively affected their lives. Hence the dramatic exploit of rage and aggression that feature most Bohr phenomena. Shakya, aggressive or antisocial behavior is typical of woman, while men and hijras tend to undergo a trance-like state featured by immobility, goose flesh, and speechlessness. I have some example here, male devotees. And they are silent, they don't speak during this phenomena. Right. So for women it's different. And according to my male informants, they go wild, they say. Bohr is preceded by loud shrieks and cries of pain. This, I have been explained, is due to the physical pain of a person naturally resisting to an external, unbearable pressure. Bohr, in fact, means weight. Some women are then shaken by an uncontrollable urge to twist their heads, roll on the ground, and shout gibberish. Others seem to engage in an altercation. In this case, the goddess, recognizable by a different tone or accent, indicates, or rather accuses, those who have contributed to the discomfort of a host. The dynamics of public blaming are particularly feared by male family members who are publicly accused of embarrassing secrets, for instance, domestic violence, cheating, homosexuality, impotence, incapacity to sustain financially the family, alcoholism, etc. So in short, what women say, human or divine, is dangerous. Abusive language is not rare, for instance, obscene sexual imagery directed towards men. This is a Potininda pattern, as well as threatening behavior, mocking fights, and physical attacks against those who are indicated by the goddess as guilty of causing sufferance or injustice. If the situation becomes dangerous or unbearable from an emotional point of view, usually an elder woman intervenes, but sometimes even passerbys. I will show you the two case studies, Bulbul and Rina. This is the beginning of the accusation. basically just naming and blaming in this stage. And there is the exploit. It's interesting also to see how the face changes. She seems younger at the end of the poem. And this is the second example. And this is the end, where an elder woman intervenes. Right. So this is just to give you an idea of what is happening during this festival. The poor experience is this a way to contrast the crisis, but it may imply some loss of what we can call social capital. This depends on the kind of blame the episode attracts, and therefore it is entirely dependent on the reaction of the bystanders. Possession gives access to a secret and monstrous, in the sense, in its latent sense, marvelous dimension, inspired by local narratives, but eventually excluded by the official mythology. It is a powerful and pedagogical practice that helps to cope with injustice, and as such, it is feared by some, whereas others are suspicious. Stories of possession, as well as experiences of possession, provide an arena to discuss relative justice, which is opposed to social justice, dharma, or shobonata, which is decency. And it's a way to enact revenge on a practical, physical level. Eventually, however, such experiences are tamed, silenced, and erased from the official history of the goddess. The official mythology of Shitala in Bengal, as elsewhere, does not include stories of possession. Although poor is far from uncommon, the fact that it is a predominantly female affair and that tends to be more popular among the working class has contributed to its marginalization. A further contended issue in Shitala worship is the presence of Bolidan. Although ritual killing in Bengal is quite popular, sacrifices in honor of Shitala specifically are increasingly difficult to witness. As per my experience, the practice of animal sacrifice is being countered by different factors, and among these, the popularization of ahimsa as a dominant feature of Hinduism at a global level, the exacerbation of communalism, whose animal for sacrifice used to be procured by Muslims, and but until 2 decades ago, it was kind of regular to see Muslims taking active part to Shitala celebrations. Yet due to the radicalization of South Asian Islam, particularly after 9/11, most Muslims are nowadays unwilling to deal in any way with Hindu rituals. Then there are other factors such as, for instance, education, most significantly the spread of hygienic norms, basic medical knowledge, ecology, global discourses on environmentalism, ecology and animal rights, economics, sacrifice is increasingly looked at as a waste of resources. The rise of global ethics, originally developed in and fostered by Western discourses, politics, sacrifice is dismissed as a distortion of true Hinduism by conservative forces, whereas the intensification of Maoist guerrilla operation in Nepal and northeastern India and the creation of a red corridor through Bihar, Jharkhand and West Bengal has determined an increase in episodes of violence related to religious performances, especially in rural areas. So animals destined to sacrifice are confiscated to feed the people's army, and those who resist have been dissuaded sometimes aggressively. But in this climate, many Shaivites or devotees just gave up. And finally, it is very important, media and the Bollywood industry, with its promotion of what we can call deodorized Hinduism. The diversity of ritual performances is either stereotyped in its representation of regional differences or annihilated. The point of view of indigenous communities or subaltern classes on their practices is overall ignored, Rituals whose focus is the promotion of widely acceptable ideas are presented as mainstream, for instance, Karva Chauth, whereas practices that may give rise to controversy are just silenced. So most Shitala devotees and ritual specialists have come to the conclusion that animal sacrifice is just counterproductive, and some argue it is indeed a backward and polluting practice. Renouncing animal sacrifice, however, is not unanimously welcome. In Shakya, this practice survives. The Bolidan is performed the day after the pilgrimage in a large temple dedicated to Boroma. The ceremony begins at around 4 p.m., but devotees gather long before in order to secure the best places in the temple so as to enjoy the show. Despite the dramatic nature of the sacrifice, due to the high expectations of the performers and the large amount of people packed in and around the temple, the performance in the Boroma Mandir is festive in nature. In the words of local informants, the whole spectacle is a display of devotion, an aim at binding new and existing votaries to the goddess. Further to that, it is an occasion for families to be reunited. The sacrifice is performed by male Brahmins only, but the venue is frequented by men and women from all social classes, and there is no regard for traditional rules of purity. Children of all ages are also present. In fact, their presence adds significantly to the celebration. Firecrackers are thrown from the balconies on pilgrims, and pranks of various natures take place. In February 2012, I observed 40 male Bhaktiya devotees. Only one of them was a hijra, and also the one who presented on behalf of her community the biggest and finest goat to the goddess. Here I have a picture. Sacrificial animals were all male, uncastrated and unblemished goats, most of them black. You can see here. This is the other exception. The ritual lasts several hours. After Shitala is invited by means of invocation, loud conch blasts and roll of drums, the chief votary from inside the Garbhagriha confirms that the goddess is present and awakened. At that point, devotees have only a few minutes to rush in the temple and secure the best spots. The Bolidan is divided in 10 stages, unlike the usual 5 mentioned in most Kali and Durga's Paddhati. The Shebites, however, in this temple do not use any ritual manual, apparently. This is what they call the Pitribhob, so the way of the forefathers. So these are the stages. We have the dedication of the goat, presentation and dedication of the goat. Then presentation of the korpor, which literally means skull, presentation of the clay dishes, where the pouring blood from the animals is kept. Worshipping of the harikat, the Y-shaped stake, which is called stombo puja. The calling, invocation, because the goddess is supposed to be here during the sacrifice, and the blade is her arm, as they say, her hand. Presentation of the cleaver, korgo. Right. The killing, boli. And then we have 2 vegetarian sacrifices. The sacrifice of the squash, which is the korgo boli, and the ikku boli, sacrifice of sugarcane. Apparently they are supposed to be substitutes for a human sacrifice, but only a few people confirm this. The other basically don't know why they are doing it. Finally, there is salutation, namaskar, and visarjan release, which is followed by the prasad, the distribution of food and blessed water. And finally, cleansing. The area, this is an extremely important part of the ritual, must be purified as soon as possible, as the presence of blood, meat, hairs, bone splinters, marrow, and traces of the animal's evacuation is likely to attract the unwanted attention of competing deities or evil spirits. Now, the Bodhi Dharma I observed in Shalkya, as well as in other Bengali locations, did not strike me for being in any way original. The most unusual feature, perhaps, is a form of apotropaic ritual, the Julai, literally swinging, taking place in the alleys behind the temple, but again, it's not something regular. Some women, most of these women were Bihari, beat big winnowing baskets, the shurp, which is also the crown worn by Shitala, in order to ward the evil eye off. This seems to be related to the presence of angry spirits who have tasted blood and meat and may then attack humans, particularly children. This ritual is typical of Diwali and seems not to be prevalent in Bengal, but according to my informants, it can be performed whenever the occasion requires it. What, however, I found extremely relevant is that there was little emphasis on the healing power of Shita. Basically, the devotees do not indicate her as a disease goddess, as she's generally advertised. Sacrifice has a paramount meaning. While all agree that it is a way to feed and please the goddess, the reason to offer an animal to Boroma are manifold. To some, it is a matter of tradition. Some votaries offer a goat as part of a vow or compensation for a fulfilled request. Some men take part to the ritual on behalf of a female family member, and in this case, motivation is often related to the lack of fertility. A tiny proportion of my informants suggested they wanted to improve their personal, generally financial situation, and be able to take better care of their families. The offering is thus a way to attract the benevolence of the goddess on a new business venture, relocation in or migration to another place, the perspective of a new job, or even in view of university exams or admission tests. I spotted some children too and had the chance to talk with their parents. Apparently, children are expected to carry on a family tradition. Protection is generally a key issue. Almost all my informants communicated to me the need to be blessed and protected. To conclude with, Bor and Bolidan are currently being discussed by most educated Bengalis as signifiers of marginalization and social stigma. Particularly animal sacrifice, because of its perceived violence on harmless creatures, is fiercely opposed. Although the Indian constitution objects cruelty against all living beings, and the Animal and Bird Sacrifice Prohibition Act has been implemented from 1950 in some states like Andhra Pradesh, Gujarat, Karnataka, Kerala, Pondicherry, Rajasthan, and Tamil Nadu, Bolli Dhan continues to be performed. But in the context of Shitala worship, those who perform or believe into animal sacrifice are victims of a twofold epistemic violence. First, Shitala does not belong to a sound scriptural tradition, such as Shaktism. Theirs is publicly advertised as a lesser tradition. The goddess devotees simply cannot throw scriptures to validate their custom, hence the delegitimation of their practices as folkloristic, primitive, barbarian, and irrational. Second, unlike Kali and Durga's votaries, who are organized in temple committees and have the power, authority, visibility, and economic means to counter objections to their practices, worshippers of Shitala are not organized. Their marginalization stems from the nature itself of their culture. So this is why I raise my objection, basically. My problem is not with the motivations, ethical, economical, environmentalist, theological, etc., of those who oppose animal sacrifice. What I find disturbing is the way this is pursued. The systematic stigmatization and marginalization of folklore and folklife should be a matter of concern, precisely because it is a form of violence on living beings. Folklore is the liveliest expression of people's knowledge, the actualization of ancestral needs and expectation, and the most efficacious, easily available, and culturally understandable form of creativity, education, and reflexivity within a society. The meta-territorial agendas of most cartels involved in the fight against animal sacrifices should consider contextual differences, especially in the case of Shitala, a goddess that gives voice to the imbalances and unevenness generated by nature and culture. The impact of these objections and the way they are delivered, particularly, proves once again that history repeats itself. The dislocation of Shitala from her onchol has already produced different oikotypes, so different creatures, so to speak. Like, for instance, the Pustula goddess, the Poja Shitala, Shitala the healer, or as some call her, the Ayurvedic Shitala. The Durgaification of Shitala in movies and theater. The Tantric Shitala, this is from Varanasi. And finally, Shitala in fine arts. So this time, the pressure exerted by globalization and its meta-territorial ethics is likely to cause the fatal loss of vernacular knowledge. Far from being an exercise in cultural relativism, these reflections invite to a firm ethical procedure when dealing with the culture of those who are in no position to defend themselves from the accusation of being primitive, an unfortunate yet still too much popular allegation in contemporary world dynamics. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Farrell.
Thank you.
Fascinating lecture. So, questions and comments.
Hello.
really interesting.
Thank you very much.
Paper. I was struck by a couple of things when you showed those images at the beginning. I was struck by how similar it is to what's happened. Mm-hmm. In Tamil Nadu with the Mariamman cult,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, she's kind of the counterpart. She's also the smallpox goddess, the goddess of rain.
Right.
But there's been this whole kind of gentrification
that's
happened. Again, very similar kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You know, no textual tradition, again, low caste, marginal, rural. And it's very interesting to sort of see those parallels. And, of course, the question of animal sacrifice is also very... But I think with the question of Mariamman, it's been quite successful, the kind of gentrification. And sort of this her becoming bourgeois is much more, it's been more complete. But I was really, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit perhaps in the context of Bengal, with the kind of gentrification that's gone on with the Kali tradition that Rachel McDermott's talked about, you know, with Kamala Kanta and Rama. And how that might dialogue with what's happening, because you talk about, you set the Mangal Kavyas at the 17th century, which is around the same time.
Yes.
So I was wondering that if you could maybe put those two into...
Well, they are kind of different because this acceleration of the gentrification process is still happening, and it's very fast, whereas for other deities like Durga, Kali, it took more time. I started observing Shitala 15 years ago, and if I check my pictures and fieldwork notes, I can actually see, when I go to visit some temples that I visited 2, 4, 5, 10 years ago, you can see all sort of, you know, differences. And now in many temples, the devotees, especially the younger generation, they say that they worship Shitala as a form of Durga. Sometimes she is on a lion with a trident, so she is really losing her identity. But I think that, after all, this is inaccurate, because there are just many Shitalas. This is my impression. So it's not that there is one goddess that is changing. There are many Shitalas, and I noticed that this is a typical pattern of Anchalik Devota, the regional vernacular deities, and it's something that I discuss in my first monograph too. These deities that have basically the same name, they are competing. So the one in a village is enemy with the other, but they have the same name. So perhaps they share some powers, some rituals, but they are very competitive and aggressive between them. Even in this case, there is a kind of underlying tension. You can feel it between those that live around and worship particularly the Chotoma, which is a dominant form of Shitla, and those that are in the around the temple of Boroma. It's a sort of, you know, class thing, really. On the one hand, they are embracing this goddess who is a mother, who is gentle. Also, the iconography is different. And they are all educated people, whereas, and they look at the others as violent, ignorant, and worshipping in a way that is non-Hindu sometimes, they say. So it's a very interesting process, and I feel in a way lucky because I witness it over the last 10-15 years. So
are there any upper class people who get possessed at all, or upper class, or is it only a phenomenon?
Yeah, this is interesting. It's generally, perhaps, yes, I cannot exclude it, but working in a rural context and with devotees that come from the rural context and are working class, I had the chance to in these big pilgrimages, for instance, you don't see poor, you know, happening to upper class. Also, I talking with gentry from Kolkata, for instance, they didn't exclude that this happens, but they don't make it public. So it may happen, but within the house. Because there is this idea, it's changing basically. What these devotees call bore, and we call possession, which is obviously wrong, now for them is, for the middle class educated person, is a form of mental illness, maybe resulting from depression. So it's resolved clinically. It's no longer related to the goddess.
Thank you
very much.
The killing of the black goat,
yeah,
reminds me the killing of the black goat, the he goat,
all right,
the Ayurveda, Shamaka.
Yeah.
And usually they used to kill a he goat black with a white leg.
All right.
But then they cooked and they shed the meat of this. Do they cook?
Yes. And this is another thing, because some of the animal rights campaigners, they say that it's completely useless to kill so many animals. But for many people here, it's perhaps the only time in the year that they eat meat.
Yeah.
So it's consumed, everything. The body goes back to the devotees, and the head stays with the priests. And this is why they tie the goat, because they want to keep all the neck, basically. So this is the dynamic. And nothing is left untouched or unconsumed. Everything is consumed.
And another interesting thing is the relation with children.
Mm.
Because if I well remember, in the Atharvaveda Samhita, there's a demon with a shape of goat.
Mm.
And he was very dangerous for women pregnant.
Oh, right,
yeah,
that's interesting.
Because, this demon could eat the fetus.
All right.
Entering from vagina and eating.
And eat the fetus.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. And the shape was the shape of
a goat.
Goat, yeah.
It's in the Atharvaveda.
In the wrong way.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So
I should check it. Thank you very much.
It's all that blood, isn't it? is it that is the rationale partly behind this the nature of Shitala? Does she demand blood offerings to appease her? That's the rationale behind it, as it were.
This is kind of a big issue, really, because for some, she is Shitala, therefore the cool one, and therefore she needs to be pacified with this. But there are really a number of traditions. So in some places, she actually doesn't need the meat for pacification. And many of my informants actually told me that the meat, the blood, the fear of animal actually inflames her.
Oh.
So there are these contrasting visions of the goddess. On the one hand, the animal sacrifice excites her. She wants more. She attacks people because she feels the meat, the flesh, the blood, and then may cause diseases. But on the other hand, many say that we need to feed her, like a human being, basically. So these are the different the rationale behind the offering. And as for disease, I said that she's wrongly generally presented as the disease goddess. In fact, I understood, and it took quite a lot of time, that it's her presence when she's dissatisfied that cause heat, and therefore we feel this as a pressure and express it as a cold possession. So it's also interesting to understand what exactly is disease, really, because the concept of disease for us is obviously different for many of these persons. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating question, really, yes. And it's changing continuously, obviously.
I'm familiar with some of the Taims in Kerala. They,
all right.
The goddess is possessed, and then once she's offered blood and alcohol, she calms down, so and then the whole process winds down. So it's a kind of catharsis element. So
yeah, in many villages, temples, I mean, it's this way, but there are also other readings of the old thing that you should absolutely avoid meat or fish in this case, the presence of particular food, because it actually excites the goddess. And
it's very interesting. And the possession seems to be distinct from the sacrificial rites in a
yeah.
sense.
There are no possession phenomena when there is the sacrifice.
Right.
Not
although
at
the
all.
Guys are getting very excited by the look.
Yeah, well, they dance a lot.
Yeah.
They dance a lot, but it's not possession at
okay.
all. It's actually it's a big show, I have to say, and I've been told many ways that it's an important occasion. Many families are reunited. They have this big meal with meat, and there is also obviously it's very influential. The Hijra community, they are on the balcony watching, and they have their representative there with usually it's always the Hijra member of the community with the biggest and finest goat. So it is a huge event for the community there.
Once a year.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I was expecting something more dramatic, but in fact there was a lot of excitement. There was the frolicsome aspect, really. So it's really interesting and fascinating festival.
I was wondering about the series of images you showed of the first woman who was possessed.
Yes.
And you said she seemed to age or get younger from the
beginning. Yeah.
Is that related at all to the content of her experience? I mean, was she...
Oof. Really, it's difficult to say. She explained to me, both the women talked to me, about their discontent. It is true that in some cases the goddess Shitala is visually rendered as a Burima, an old lady. So, but I really don't know. It's difficult to answer because it's so subjective. I mean, she was speaking in that case in Bhojpuri, so not in Bengali. But it wasn't the tone, I would say, of an old person. I mean, it's something that I witnessed in the past, but not in this case. But it is true that when I was observing it, and then I'm looking at the pictures, she has, probably you all noticed this, she seemed much older, really.
Yeah, I think from the first one to the last one is really striking.
Exactly, it is, yeah. It is striking, yeah.
And then another question, just briefly. When they're doing the sacrifices, I notice there's a picture of Lakshmi and a picture of Krishna in the
yes.
temple. Is there no qualms about performing this in front of these?
No, exactly. And this is something, I mean, if you go, I have a whole range of images from a lot of temples. It's incredible. I mean, you can find in these small shrines all the deities. I mean, and obviously for us it makes no sense whatsoever because, as you said, is it possible a sort of celebration like this with baby Krishna in the corner? It's striking. But it's a way to probably also it is a way to make a point that this particular goddess is just like the other more, you know, let's say pan-Hindu deities, perhaps. Because it's something that you don't find in other temples where some more widely worshipped deities are present. Whereas in these small shrines with these angelic deities or gods, you find reference to most deities, really. Thank you.
I was interested in this accusation that some possessions are fake.
All right.
I've been in a Jain pilgrimage site in Rajasthan where I observed the same thing, that people were saying that 90% of all these possessions are fake, but some are.
Where was it?
In western Rajasthan, close to Balotra.
All right. I was wondering if it was Balaji, perhaps.
No. Nakoda Bhairav was the...
All right, okay.
I was a bit stumbled by this fake, non-fake. But could you tell me more? Did you hear more of how can one distinguish? Why would one want a fake one?
Yeah, it's an interesting. The point is that it's a sort of defense, especially from male family members, by saying that the woman is mad and therefore she's performing theater. You are diminishing the accusation itself. And in fact, for most of these women, it doesn't matter if they are actually possessed. And obviously, we are talking about something that is, you know, subjective. But it still is a way to say something, to defend, to protect themselves from sometimes really a miserable life. So it's a sort of dialogue between... two groups, the exploited one and the exploiter, and the way to pathologize possession, to say no, it's not possession, it's not Chittalama, it's you are just mad, so you are nothing, basically, that makes a more comfortable man who therefore can reject all these sort of accusation. And as you're saying, it's typical. I mean, I'm not surprised at all that you witnessed in a completely different era, because I witnessed this in sub-Himalayan areas, in Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, so I'm not aware of South India. Did you perhaps have any...
Yeah, they do. I mean, a lot of the time you'll get people saying that the possession is fake.
It's fake,
or,
yeah.
It's not really true, but I think what's interesting, I think, in the South is that there's a lot of fear associated with
fear.
That there's a fear that what if the possession is true and it's really the goddess, right? So there's a sense of like you don't want to delegitimate the possession because
you never know.
But I mean, I think and generally, if you go to particular temples, they'll be the same people that is possessed. You know, they'll be the regular possessees. You'll be told, oh, go to that if you want to see like a really good possession. To that corner, and that's the old lady who will get possessed. But again, it's very similar to what you say. Yeah. A lot of the possession is women getting possessed who.
I was surprised.
These,
No, go on, please.
Who are usually in these very awful domestic situations?
Yeah.
Who use that moment to kind of say, you know, you're a drunkard, you spent all the money, blah blah.
You go
blah.
With
sometimes
women, something like that. Yeah.
And sometimes it's actually violence. You know, they beat the man and so forth. So I think it's very similar.
Some even hurt themselves,
yes,
so they have to be restrained. And I was surprised, and this was new for me. This link with migrants. So this strong accusation from Bengali Bhadralok, you know, this is not what we do, it's them, it's Bihari or UP people. We don't do this. When in fact, if you go in the Bengali countryside, you see this performed by Bengalis. But most of these people were from Kolkata. So they were very, and there is in fact, if you're familiar with the dynamics of Kolkata, this kind of clash between Bengalis and migrants, Bihari or UP people. And so, in retrospect, I was not surprised, but it was new for me to witnessing this, because probably is a, how can I say, multicultural festival in a way, so people coming from different backgrounds.
They're probably not that interested in the actual inner state of the person, as long as the performance takes place. It's a performative thing. Certainly in Kerala, we've asked these Tayans, what's going on? Are you really possessed? And they say, some of them say, oh no, I'm just pretending. Some say, I don't remember what happens. And some say, yes, I'm possessed by the goddess. But it seems like an irrelevant question to them in a way. It seems to be the public performance that counts.
It seems like in the Santeria Cubana.
And I was recently...
not interested in the inner state of the individual.
Or something we had in Italy.
In Italy, with the Catholic Virgin Mary,
Tarantismo and all this kind of...
Is there any divination that takes place?
Sorry?
Is there any divination that happens during possession?
Not in this festival, but I witnessed this in other areas, yes. Okay. There are individuals that know how to get possessed, and then they, yes, they tell future or explain things to happen. Many of them are also members of Adivasi communities, so we would call them shamans, or male and female. And in the past, I heard that there were also Muslims or Sufis, Fakir. But now the situation, as I mentioned, it's changing quite a lot. There is a big divide. I mean, once the situation was more fluid, but now, especially the Muslims, they don't want to deal with practices that are Hindu, I'd say.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to you.
Have to wind up, so thank you.
Thanks.